lucky in the lab late one night.
Well, obviously, you know this is not the John Williams show if that song is being played. This is Rick Hogan doing his best to fill in for John as he's gone much of the week. That is a tune from an old CD made for me by a music professor at the University of Kentucky named Ron Penn. And it's a collection of Halloween stuff, so you'll be hearing that all during the show. It is my great and somewhat strange honor to welcome as my first guest today, Stephen Haas. Because, Stephen, I don't know if I met you as a young child or an infant, because I certainly knew both of your parents before you were born.
Yeah, we may have met. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I may have touched your mom, Sally Edwards' tummy when she said, look, we're having a baby.
You were the one. I remember that.
Oh, there had to be more than one. She lived in the wide world of comedy, as do you. Stephen Haas is a performer, a writer, a television maker, a video maker, a talented stand-up who just finished a few days at Zany's, which is basically a place you grew up, because your dad, Bert Haas, has been working at Zany's since 1980, managing the Zany's empire now. Your mom, Sally Edwards, is a talented stand-up. How could they even let you get into the stupid business?
That's a good
Stephen?
Question.
I know. I've asked your father that question.
I don't know. They've been supportive, but yeah, I want to ask. We should have brought them with.
I'll ask him. I did ask him at one point, because your brother and sister are studying these sort of rarefied things. We'll get into that too. But what's your first memory of Zany's? Did they bring you there as a child?
Not too much. I didn't grow up in the back of the showroom watching all the shows or anything like that. But I do remember the Vernon Hills Club, or I think maybe the Mount Prospect Club, being in the green room and the office, and sometimes they would have to take us with to work.
Was there any sense, was there something romantic about it? I remember my father was a newspaper man taking me into the old city room at the Daily News and the Sun-Times, and I have incredibly fond memories of it. Is that, did it something get under your skin at that time or no?
Maybe. If it did, then it's probably at a subconscious level.
Or maybe you would just have to be older to realize what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe you have to be my age to realize it. When then did you decide? Yeah, you went to Columbia College here in Chicago to study film production.
Yeah, and I've always been writing comedy. I knew I wanted to write comedy.
Why?
About high school.
Why?
I was really sick of making jokes and then having to go, that was a joke. And then everyone go, oh, that was a joke.
Well, your dad said, when I interviewed him sometime.
Okay, that's ought to be good.
He says that he has never had an urge to perform, ever.
Yeah.
And he would come home, and there's probably no living person who has heard more jokes than Bert Haas. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's probably true.
He said that when I interviewed him about starting a comedy school down there, he said about you, he was always funny. He understood joke structure when he was three. Now, that's just got to be a proud dad going nuts, right? You don't understand joke structure at three, could you?
I can't think of any examples, but yeah, I don't know. That's a very nice quote. I hope that's true.
Well, were you, as a kid, were you class clown?
No, I was very quiet. I would make jokes in the back of the class, but yeah, most of the time people didn't really know that they were jokes. And, yeah, very quiet.
When you decided, I suppose, when you go to college in Columbia and you decide to stay here and get into film production, was it the notion of making Forrest Gump or Citizen Kane or making comedy?
Oh, just comedy. I grew up with The Simpsons. I've probably watched every, Simpsons episode
many
times. And, yeah, just always comedy writing. I knew I wanted to write comedy. And then stand-up is just another medium for comedy writing.
You've had some success as a screenwriter, haven't you?
A little bit, not
well,
too
won
much.
An award. Well, you won an award.
Yeah.
What's the art of writing comedy?
Man, that's a...
That's what I'm known for, tough questions. That's
no,
what
that,
I'm known
no, I love that. What's the art of writing comedy? I think it's just as simple, funny. Try to make it cut out as many words as you can and just, make it funny. It's hard to describe.
Yeah,
I remember I heard a great interview with Woody Allen where I think he sums it up where you can't trace the genesis of a joke is how he said it. And I think that's so true, is when you think of a joke, whether it's stand-up or screenwriting, like, you laugh when you think of it because you just heard it for the first time.
Huh.
And I don't know, he said, and I agree with that, there's really no way to figure out how it popped into your head.
In the writing and trying to conceptualize jokes for film and or television, it's a vastly different thing than trying to write and conceptualize for the stage and for stand-up. When do you feel that transition happening, when you feel bold enough to say, yeah, I'm going to get up in front of a crowd, even at my dad's club, and perform live? What's that transition all about?
Yeah, I think it's, for me, it was just I really wanted to try out some jokes. I remember I tried them out at open mics. I didn't go to Zany's right away. But, yeah, I remember the first time I had some jokes and I really wanted to try them. I walked to the open mic, and then I walked home. I didn't even go in the building, and I was like, that was good. That was pretty good. I got to the building, and then the second week, I went back, and I did a lap around the building, and then I went home.
Was it insecurity or fear?
Yeah.
Fear?
It's terrifying to try stand-up for the first time.
I have heard that. I have never done it either, but I've covered comedy for years, very intensely in the 80s when Zany's was taking off. And you are stripped naked emotionally in every other way when you're on that stage, aren't you?
It's a very vulnerable experience, and it can be really tough.
We got to take a break. I'm here for another half hour with Stephen Haas, who in many ways won a sort of genetic pool. His dad is probably heard more jokes than any living human being. He is Bert Haas, the manager of the Zany's Empire, and a guy who's worked at that club since 1980, when people didn't even know what stand-up was. He worked for the great Rick Uwod, and his mom is Sally Edwards, who herself was a very talented, may still be, I don't know, if your mom's still performing?
She does shows occasionally.
I haven't seen her enough. I remember seeing her a lot.
I should have brought them with.
On the stage at Zany's. We could have a comedy fest here. The next time I fill in for John, we'll have the entire Haas gang, including your older brother, Brendan, who studied, has a PhD in astrophysics. Go figure. Go figure. My guest is Stephen Haas, a stand-up comic, filmmaker, TV maker, and many other things. We were just talking about his first experience with stand-up and getting up on stage. And it's interesting, that song, I didn't play it on purpose, but, you know, comics have forever talked about dying on stage when a joke goes flat or a routine doesn't work. Okay, you've told us about going to an open mic thing, going to the building, walking home, going back to the building, walking around the building. What was it like, Stephen Haas, when you first got up on stage and did a stand-up routine?
My experience with it, and I've had other people tell me they had the same experience, was the first time went very well. Very well. And then you're like, wow, that went a lot better than I was expecting. And then it goes not well for a long time after that.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. But I've heard a lot of people say that. They go the first time, maybe it's because you're just like so amped up on adrenaline, but
it went
surprisingly well.
Let's address that whole thing, that whole notion. You hear it from every comic. I mean, they'll walk off the stage and say, you know, I died up there. Is it like some kind of little death? I mean, is it when you really bomb? And I'm not saying you ever have, Stephen Haas. When you've seen other comic friends bomb, it must be a terribly emotional kind of experience. You must feel every ounce of your insecurity.
Yeah, it can be. It's very discouraging. Even if a joke doesn't work and there's that silence afterwards, there's a lot of thinking. You have a lot to think about on the way home.
Let me ask you now. I mean, you obviously, you've been a host at Zany's, and it's not nepotism, even though your dad runs the Zany's Empire with Rick Uwot's wife, his widow, Rick Uwot, the guy who started Zany's in an era when there was no stand-up. You saw and have seen a lot of acts come and go through a lot of different rooms. You now live in L.A. Who have been... You mentioned Woody Allen as a filmmaking influence, I would think. What about a guy like Mel Brooks?
Wait, as a stand-up influence?
As an influence in comedy in general.
That's interesting. I haven't... not one of mine personally, honestly. I haven't watched too much Mel Brooks. My dad loves Mel Brooks.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah.
So do I.
And unfortunately, he's when you just never...
Oh, in the stand-up world, then.
Yeah.
I'm from the era when you've opened for my old friend Emo Phillips.
Oh, he's so funny.
Who is coming back. He is as distinctive It's impossible to describe Emo's act, I think. He's coming to Zanies in a little while. You can go to Zanies.com or Zanies Comedy Club, blah, blah, .com. You can find it. You can also go to Stephen Haas Comedian. .com, which is a nice website. It's got a lot of clips of you.
It's got some of my work on there. Yeah,
it
check
does.
It out.
It has a lot of your work up there. I'm going to have you after the news break at the half hour. Do if you would, if you can do it. You're not going to bomb here. You're not going to die here. Do a couple minutes of your act.
Okay.
Because one of the things that distinguishes your act is it is touted as clean comedy. What does that mean?
It's there's no. You know,
profanity
or any topics that might make people uncomfortable. It's all observational, autobiographical. And so I guess it just doesn't skew too dirty.
Well, so I've got to think that people like Jay Leno and Jerry Seinfeld as stand-ups might be influence of your... I've never seen either of those guys work blue, as they say.
Yeah, Brian Regan, those kind of people, definitely huge influences.
Don't you find, though, as I did, when the crowds that come to comedy clubs over the years are predisposed, they're predisposed to have a good time. So in some sense, you have the crowd in the palm of your hand the minute they walk in. But don't you find a lot of them are eager for or, you know, there are certain words that even used in a bad joke, bad words will make people laugh. And I find that the sort of cheapest kind of form of humor. Do you?
I don't want to, you know,
no,
trash any of that. But, yeah, it can definitely be a crutch, I think.
Yeah.
And when I was starting out, just watching open mics, you can see people who use it as a crutch. And it's something that I think can be avoided if you specifically try not to do it.
Before we get into your performance, which will be in a few minutes after the news.
Do we have a laugh track we're going to add to this? Or?
We'll laugh in here. We'll laugh in here. Everybody will laugh in here. We'll get all the other producers in here to laugh it up. And it's such a joy for me to be working with the woman who taught me so much about radio, Elif Garris, who is John's producer. And before that was my producer. And now she has regular hours and a much tougher job. What's your aspiration? Do you want to make films? You know, the old route years ago when your dad and I were hanging out at Zany's all the time, it was, okay, let me get a good 7 minutes, then I can get on Johnny Carson, then I can get a TV show. That doesn't exist anymore.
Unfortunately, not too much. I think my opinion on it, which is sort of, I guess, I think everyone in the entertainment industry has their own strategy that they're trying to employ, but I think that auteur is sort of where it's going. You have to be able to do everything. You have to be a filmmaker, a performer, actor. You have to know how to edit. You have to know all this stuff. And I'm definitely trying to do that, produce my own work. Stand-up is just one aspect of that.
You're a good guy. Go to Stephen with a V, Stephen Haas, H-A-A-S, comedian.com to get some samples. Or just stay tuned to get a live sample. I know he's going nuts. He's sweating. He's going to leave the studio.
I got to write some jokes.
Welcome back. This is Rick Kogan filling in for John Williams, and I have a few more minutes with Stephen Haas, a talented young, not only a stand-up, but a filmmaker and a television maker and a video maker, and you can see his oeuvre at StephenHaasComedian.com, and do take a look. It's a nice website, Stephen.
Oh, thank you.
I promised you, well, he has an older brother who has a PhD in astrophysics. He has a younger sister, Christine, who has a degree in architecture, and his wonderful parents, Bert Haas, the manager of the Zanies Empire, and his wife, Sally Edwards, a talented comedian in her own right, have the black sheep of the family in you, but I know they're really proud of you, Stephen.
Oh, yeah. No, they're great parents.
Yeah, and they're very supportive, too. That's another thing. You cannot be in the business you're in without the support of your family. Would you give this wonderful WGN audience a couple minutes? I know this is a difficult thing because you're a stand-up and now you're sitting, among other things, and you don't perform with headphones on.
Not usually, no.
But you do perform into a mic. Could you give just a small sample of Stephen Haas comedy?
Sure. One thing I like to talk about, I got a new dentist. And I think this is really interesting because my new dentist is my age. And I think that's terrifying. He looks like me. He looks like he's in his late 20s. Immediately, he walked in. I was just like, you got to go find an adult. Get your dad. I don't care if he's a dentist. Just get someone else in here. My new dentist's name is Tyler. No, thanks. That's okay. I'll take a Charles. Take an Edward. I'll take an old school name. I'm not doing... That's a class action lawsuit I don't really want to be a part of. Tyler, the millennial dentist. You know, I don't know what that's going to be like. His root canal is lit. That's no thanks. I'll pass on that one. But yeah, it's good to be back. I always stay with my parents when I get back here. My mom, right now, she talks about wanting to retire. That's what she likes to talk about. And it's hard for me to talk to her about that, just because I thought she was retired. And so I don't know what to say. She is on my mom. If you want to get an idea of my mom's life, just in case you're curious, she spent a Tuesday signing me up for The Bachelorette. That was her Tuesday. Yeah. I didn't know you could sign other people up. She just came into my room and she goes, "Steven, I think I'm going to sign you up for The Bachelorette." And I said, "Please do not do that." She goes, "I did it yesterday." I was like, "I'm glad we had this discussion, Mom. This is good. I think I'll probably be the first contestant on the show to get dropped off in a minivan."
Pretty, Steven, you use, obviously, how often do you use your parents in any of your routines?
Only when they're listening to me on the radio.
They have seen you perform, I would assume, in a number of times. Do Bert and Sally, do they give you advice, or are they kind of hands-off? Because, again, I said, your dad has probably heard more jokes than almost any living human being, having worked at Zany since 1980 and run it for many years. Do they give you advice, or are they supportive in a way, go find your own way?
It's, I think, a mix of both. Sometimes they'll give advice, but they're just very supportive. But when, yeah, they do give some. If they notice something, if my mom's notices something, I used to have this habit when I first started out where I would sway on stage, you know, almost like when someone is like holding a baby and they sway back and forth. Yeah. And I don't know why I did that, but thankfully my mom was the one who told me I was swaying on, like, that sort of stuff. They'll chime in when they notice something.
Steven Haas, I've known your parents forever. I've known Zany's forever, and it is an absolute pleasure to meet you. I think you're smart, and you think, you're a thinking comic, and that's part of it. Yeah, you do. You do, and you are. Ladies and gentlemen, go to Steven Haas, H-A-A-S, comedian.com, and you will get some more of his comedy in a variety of different ways, in video, and in audio. Steven, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you. It was great to be on.
Come back the next time when you've got a big movie. You say, I don't do John Williams show, even with Rick Hogan. Hi, Rick Hogan filling in for John Williams. If I had a car, I'd give it to Cars for Kids, but I've never owned a car. So there you go. When I go to the 16th Street Theater, I either take public transportation or I take a cab or I have a friend take me there. And if you have never been to the 16th Street Theater in Berwyn, shame on you. It is one of the most creative and intimate and adventuresome theaters that has ever been in this town. I've covered theater in this town for a long time. It is my pleasure to have in here the artistic director and the founder of the 16th Street Theater and filmer. She has brought, I guess I got to call
Rick.
You. Hi, Ann. I guess, Esteban Andres Cruz, I got to call you the title character in Koalas.
That's right.
You play a koala in a fascinating and I don't know if I want to call it heart-wrenching. It's gotten some great reviews so far. It's a provocative show. Mm-hmm. When you, and you are from Berwyn too, are you not, Esteban?
I was born in Berwyn and raised in Cicero. I'm a graduate of Morton East High School.
That's close enough to the 16th Street Theater. Do you have
That's a musical, born in Berwyn, raised in Cicero.
When you before we get into the show itself, when you are auditioning in the role, were you auditioning specifically for the role of the koala?
Correct.
When you are auditioning, you're a working actor and you're called in to audition for a role of a koala, what kind of preparation might be involved in that?
Well, I actually got pretty sick because I ate a lot of eucalyptus. And apparently it's toxic for humans. And so, and I got, you know, I walked into, I was hanging out in the tree in the back of the theater, you know, scratching my back and whatnot on it. And I got into the theater and then I noticed I had all these ants on me. So they're,
so method.
They're totally method. Totally, totally.
Ann Filmer, it's so great to see you always. Esteban, it's great to meet you. When you first, this is a world premiere.
Mm-hmm.
What was your feeling the first time you read it? You must have to read a play about a dozen times before you really conceptualize it. But what did you think the first time you read it?
Well, actually, the first time I experienced the play was actually at a reading at Chicago Dramatists. I was called, and it was just a weird happenstance as I was called in by Chicago Dramatists to come in and do a session with a group of six playwrights. And what they do is they meet once a week, and two playwrights per week read their work to each other, or they have the other writers read the work. So not only did I hear the play for the first time, but I heard it read by playwrights. And so first I thought, okay, you know, writers are wonderful, but writers as actors, you know, it depends.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
maybe like Sam Shepard. Sam Shepard.
Yeah. Oh,
some,
yeah.
They're rare.
They are rare. And the ones that can do both are, you know, usually brilliant. So, you know, I had, you know, mild expectations.
It was
fantastic.
Had you known the playwright?
No. So this is just, and this is, okay, this is weird. And I'm, you know, I'm a real destiny girl, right?
Yes, you are.
I pay attention to destiny and serendipity. But we had already chosen the theme for our season, heroes, right? So we decided that we were going to confront something that makes me very uncomfortable, which is telling stories about men and women who serve in uniform.
Yeah.
Only because that their stories to me are so terrifying, and I am just in awe of what they put themselves through.
Well, there's also, and you can get in on this too, Esteban, when you're dealing with something like that, you've never fought in combat. I don't know if you've fought in combat. There's a depth there that you, there's no frame of reference.
Right, exactly. I can never say, oh yeah, I know how you feel, right? Yeah. That's not, so I thought, okay, who are we going to talk about that is just so far from our experience as artists? So we already had our hero season chosen, and then here we read a play. I hear a play that's actually about a war veteran from the Gulf War and his struggle with dealing with authority and dealing with his child who does not conform to what he thinks a young girl should be. And of course it's 1999, and he feels the world changing and leaving him behind.
Yeah.
And I right away I was like, pulled the playwright aside and I said, I know we don't know each other. Let's have lunch and let's talk about getting your play done at 16th Street Theater.
Was it a difficult thing for you? It does not, and this must be to your credit too, Esteban Andres Cruz, that to have an animal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In a play that is not the dog in Little Orphan Annie or something.
Thank goodness.
but is an intrinsic, I mean, one of the things mm-hmm. about your character is you in many ways drive that show.
Yep. Mm. Yep.
Do you feel that way, Andres?
Well, I feel like, you know, the title Koalas, a lot of people ask, you know, well, there was only one koala, and the title is plural.
Yeah.
You have a girlfriend
in the
back. After they see the show, and they see how we can compare animal behavior to human behavior, and how we think we're so evolved and so enlightened, but yet what a lot of times when we see a tragic character and his tragic flaw is usually because he can't be honest in a way that an animal can be honest about their needs and wants. We see these parallels happening between the animal kingdom and the human world. And we're actually treating them like animals and putting them on display in a, you know, in a diorama, or what's the word that we use? In an exhibit.
Yeah.
So you're seeing human beings on an exhibit on display.
Through the eyes of the koala. So you're right. The koala drives the play because we are seeing humans through the koala's eyes and seeing them fight for the same thing, territory, mm-hmm. what it means to be a man.
and denying these very human things that are necessary to them, while at the same time, in just my own personal take, I'm longing for those things that they have that are human, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, there is a sense, and, you know, I said that sort of facetiously at the beginning, like, how did you study for this? But I got to tell you, your performance is physically very intriguing to me because I don't know. I have never observed a koala for any length of time.
They're always sleeping. You can never see them at the zoo, right?
That's right. They're asleep.
Right.
But your movements were, it's almost like a portion of like dance of a sort. Mm-hmm. Am I wrong, Ann?
No. It's right. And what I love about Esteban and why he has the role is because he's able to take the qualities of an animal and not do like, oh, here's what a koala exactly looks like, because he can't look like a koala because he's a man.
Yeah.
But what he can do is find the elements of what does a koala want and need, and what are his desires and movements, and actually then show that in physical form.
Well, even you see it when you were eating the fake eucalyptus leaves on the tree in the play.
We don't want to get called in by the union for feeding him actual eucalyptus.
And you had never worked at 16th Street before.
I actually came a year ago.
That's a good story.
To do Into the Beautiful North, a beautiful play about a young Mexican girl leading her community and showing how beautiful Mexican immigrants are, which is something we desperately need.
We need to hear.
Exactly. And it was the first time I had ever been working in theater now for 20 years. The first time I'd ever been in an all-Latino cast.
Wow.
Which was incredible. And doing that kind of work and working with Anne and Miguel, the co-director, and finding the kind of yes that we have in the room at 16th Street Theater, I had a round-trip ticket to go back to Los Angeles. They brought me out for one show, and I gave back the ticket because I fell in love. I joined the company. Mm-hmm. We applied for the Fox Fellowship through the Theater Communications Group, this national endowment, and we won. And all of my friends who've won this award, they're like, you don't get it on your first time. Just it's a way to learn, you know. But we won, and now we're making theater together. I've gone to Puerto Rico and built roofs for 3 months.
That's part of the fellowship.
In the name of 16th Street Theater, and creating work where we create, you know, we kind of nudge humanity towards a better understanding of itself and its expansive and ever-reaching concept of what humanity is.
Well, that's what theater should do. But you are sitting with me, and I would not be able to name a greater admirer of the work done at 16th Street Theater. But what is it? It has ever been a mystery. I can't put my finger on it. I cannot define the greatness of 16th Street Theater in a sentence. Can you?
If I were to, I think it is celebrating every voice that is in our community.
That's pretty good.
And I think that's what it is. And I think part and parcel to that is anybody who loves 16th Street Theater also loves Ann Filmer. And she's at the center of it and pushing this idea that we don't have to subscribe to these big institutional corporate notions of what art should be. But if you believe in something, and just to get back to the story about koalas and how this play happened, when she approached Jacob,
he's the playwright.
He's the playwright. He was like, oh, okay, sure, you're interested in my play. And then she came back and asked him again, like, no, we want to do your play. And he's like, really? You were serious? Because Anne lacks pretense, like nobody's business, and is it's so refreshing to have that kind of directness and like somebody who states directly what they want. When in this industry, in this business, you get a lot of weeble wobbly.
Oh my god!
People.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a world premiere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. First time, and for Jacob, it's his first production in Chicago. And this play has been developed all across the country, but
it's a Eugene O'Neill finalist.
It is, yeah. Yeah. It's the first yes, so we hope that it has other productions following.
It starts with a man in his home. It's 1999, and his child, who has spent most of his time with the mom, the divorced mom, is in that house. The child is played by what I think is a terribly talented young young actor named
Leo Sharkey.
That's a tough role for a kid, don't you think, Esteban? That's a tough role for a kid because he's
He doesn't just play one character.
He plays like basically sort of three. He plays himself, conflicted between boy and girl.
Yep, a two-spirit.
He plays his father as a young man. That's a tough
one. Young Ray.
What do you think about that role?
Well, you know, Leo's my buddy. And he's a great kid, probably eats too much candy, but we have a great time. And we actually, you know, I've mentored him a bit on the role and on his work. And he realized part through this process that this is unlike other shows he's been in before.
Yeah.
Where he comes on and, like, there are other people around to say, okay, go do your scene now, and then you're done.
Right.
And, like, it's like one scene, two scenes maybe. But this is a true ensemble show.
No question.
Where
no question.
It's five actors, and we all carry almost equal amounts of... It's definitely centered around Ray, or centered around Nate, you could argue.
I would argue it's centered around both of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, or me. Yeah. It could be. You could say it's the play is about any one of these five people, and that's also a nod to it being a true ensemble show. So when it is an ensemble show like that, he's given an equal amount of responsibility as these four veteran actors, adult actors, who've been doing this
for many years
professionally.
Yeah.
And that's a lot for a kid, for an actor of his size, to step up to the plate and take on that role and shine the way he does.
Yeah.
We're all incredibly proud of him and the work that he's doing.
Well, I know he feels the same way about the cast, too. That lobby scene on opening night was one of intense joy. And Filmer missed it because she was doing something very exciting somewhere else. You can learn all about Koalas is on for another couple weeks.
Yeah, two more weeks.
16th Street Theater. That is 16th Street Theater with an ER.org. Get your tickets. It's also one of the great intimate houses. Mm-hmm. You know, Red Orchid has an intimate house, and Red Orchid's in the city, 16th Street's in Berwyn. Mm-hmm. They're wonderfully intimate, and especially for this play where you can see Esteban Andres Cruz in a tree most of the time, eating eucalyptus leaves.
And singing Andrew Lloyd Webber songs.
Yes, and singing songs. He does everything, this guy, this young, talented actor. You have only about two more weeks to see and enjoy and be moved by and provoked by the world premiere of a play called Koalas, which is at the 16th Street Theater in Berwyn. Lots of parking in the neighborhood, a lot of nice restaurants over on Roosevelt Road. Mm-hmm. Ann Filmer is the artistic director and founder of the theater and the discoverer of Koalas, what I'll say. And Esteban Andres Cruz is the title character in the show, doing a remarkable... He plays a koala. This is not a laugh-a-minute show. There are some laughs in it, but it is a thought-provoking show about people trying to cope. I mean, you know, if you had a one-line kind of thing for it, it's a real ensemble work. Also starring, I'm just going to mention my buddy in the show, Leo Sharkey, is a fifth grader and does a remarkable job. Who are the other cast members?
Yeah, we have Michelle DeMasso plays Gabby, and Michael Holding plays John, the unemployed brother who stops by to needs a place to live, and Ray Slinger, who everything is centered around him. He's the Gulf War veteran. He is played by Eddie DiZzolo.
That's a tough role too.
Yeah,
don't you think as an actor? I mean, Ann, you are an actor too. But that's a tough role, man. Mm-hmm. He's
holding on to a lot.
Yeah, Eddie and I talked a lot about self-care, which a lot of times as actors in this industry, we tend to put ourselves in these precarious situations, especially emotionally and psychically. And coming into a role like this, you got to have a separation of church and state at some point and be able to take care of yourself, because he carries a lot in the show.
Mm-hmm. And the wonderful director I want to mention is Josh Sobel.
Yes.
He's the director.
Well, that's done a remarkable directing job, because as you said, Esteban, this is a real ensemble work. I mean, everybody is interacting with everybody, and Leo Sharkey is playing three different characters. I've always found the most haunting of them playing his own father as a young man. That is just a killer.
Yeah,
and I think it takes people in the audience a moment, I think, to realize that's who he is. Do you think so too, Esteban?
Yeah, well, you know, being a new work, and our theater is centered around the playwright. It's a playwright's theater. We want to be there to facilitate the best storytelling that we can for Jacob. And so there were iterations of the play that were different than what you had seen, all the way up until opening night, even, you know, up. So we had changes coming at us, so that we could tell the story in the best way possible for what Jacob needed. So yeah, you see him, you see Nate playing different things, and it's a lot.
But you know, but I think the playwright that's purposeful, that mm-hmm. it, you know, I mean, I know it says in the playbill, you know, who reads the playbill, but if you do, it says young Ray, but really that is that Ray Slinger, is that the father of Ray Slinger who Ray took care of, right? Or, and is that, you know, is it himself? Is it is it the voices in his head that he hears his own father talking to yeah. him? So it's open. And when we have our post show dialogues, because you know that's a lot of what we do, we have the play,
and that's a great thing too.
And it's wonderful to hear from the audience, because there's no right or wrong answer. It's mm-hmm. just an exploration. Well, what did young Ray mean to you, and what did you get from those interactions? But they are haunting.
Yeah,
it's a good show for Halloween.
It's a great show for Halloween. There are two more weeks to see Koalas. Again, it's 16th Street, 16thstreettheater.org to get tickets. Hey, Esteban Andres Cruz, what is it like for a kid who grew up born in Berwyn and grew up in Cicero to have this kind of hometown thing going on, man?
Well, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And it's joyous in a way. To come, and especially when I get to work with the students at Morton, because I see them, they see me on stage.
That's a local high
school. High school. And we just launched our impact program, which is this high school and their theater work here at our theater. So we have a great relationship with the community, and it's so great going back to the school and telling these kids, you have an opinion, you have a voice, and it matters.
You matter.
And this theater here that we do, this is a way that you can tell your stories, stories that matter. So it feels so great to be able to give them that gift and let them know that they're beautiful and that they matter. So, yeah.
Now, that is as good a definition of what goes on at 16th Street Theater as I can imagine. Ann Filmer, the artistic director and founder. It is always a thrill to see you.
Thanks, Rick.
Esteban Andres Cruz, now that we've met, I will watch your career soar.
Right.
But you'll always be tied to Berwyn and Cicero,
absolutely,
as far as I'm concerned. Leslie Zemeckis, it's nice to finally meet you, because I really do feel that I have become, I don't know, your official biographer.
Yes, you have. Thank you.
You feel the same way?
Absolutely.
How did I first come upon your books?
Either that or the first movie, Behind the Burlicue.
I think they were sort of
both
together.
Yeah.
You have fashioned what I think is a now somewhat astonishing career as, seriously, you're laughing,
but
filmmaker and author. This seemed to all start in L.A. when you did a burlesque show of your own, right?
Well, it was burlesque inspired. Which, because it was inspired, I didn't really know what burlesque was.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. But you did research, didn't you?
Yes, I did a lot. And then that's what led me to decide to do the first movie, which went to the first book, which was Behind the Burlicue, The History of Burlesque, because I didn't find anybody had really talked to the women in burlesque and really what was their story.
Well, see, some of the books, and I did some research, too, when I first encountered you and the books, there would be sort of quickie books, superficial kinds of books, mostly written by men, therein lying one of the great problems.
I think all of them written by men.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Yeah. And highlighting the comedians, and they would say a little bit about the women's act, but not, you know, where they came from, where they went, blah, blah.
Well, I found it a very sexist way of telling the story of burlesque, where you would spend more time on the baggy pants comic than you would on the... And
exactly.
We both have to... And I think we're both sophisticated enough, Leslie Zemeckis, to realize that one of the reasons that burlesque was popular had more to do with the women, I believe, the women performing in, but that's what drew an audience. No one was coming. It's like Playboy. I read Playboy for the articles. I go to Burlesque to see that comic pour water on his head.
Exactly.
Ha, ha, ha. No one would believe that. When you started doing research, the research led you to, if memory serves, and it always doesn't, led you to sort of orchestrate a reunion.
Yes.
With former Burlesque stars.
Yes.
And in Las Vegas at the old, I think it's Bygone Stardust Hotel, right?
Yeah, right before they blew it up. Yeah, and that, you know, gave them a chance to reconnect, and it also let me then get their stories. And then from that, it grew into 2 years of other research. And, you know, sadly, most of them are gone.
Yeah.
Just in that time.
What did you sense? I remember the book, and I remember the individual stories, but what did you sense about the camaraderie between these women, many of whom, and this goes to the sort of heart of your latest book, Feuding Fan Dancers, where you would think would be intensely competitive, but it wasn't always.
No, it was really, there was a lot of camaraderie. I think they felt, because they were in such an odd career, they really felt like, and one of them told me, you know, it was us against them. You know, there was the other people out there, and we stayed in our community, and I think they were hugely, for the most part, supportive of each other. Now, they didn't want their acts stolen, so they could be very protective of that. But I think they were generally pretty good to each other.
Well, also the whole notion of someone in that profession being kind of deemed an outsider,
right,
too, is something that would give them a collective respect for one another.
Yes, absolutely, because they knew they weren't doing anything wrong. They knew what they were doing. They were working really, really hard.
Also, I've often thought, and now, you know, you started doing all this before any of the Me Too explosion. These women, almost all of them, including Mabel Stark, about whom we will talk soon, that's the subject of one of the most astonishing documentaries I've ever seen. I'm not kidding you.
I love that story.
I know I can be hyperbolic. I can be more hyperbolic in person than I can be in print. But I love that movie. We'll talk more about Mabel Stark, too. There's one of the great... she's something out of a great novel, but she was real. There's a real that sort of feminist feeling to these guys, to these people, even before that word was commonly used.
Absolutely. I mean, they were really creating not just their careers, but their lives on their own, and it wasn't dictated by a man or a husband, and they were extremely independent, really against the odds, you know, Mabel in particular.
Sure.
But you know, all these women, you know, their families didn't want them to go into burlesque or stripping. But it afforded them something that they couldn't have had otherwise. It really gave them opportunity.
Listen, there's something that I've never touched on in any of the stories I've written about you. Where are you from?
California, San Diego.
What's your background? I mean, it's not a academic background, is it?
Because not at all.
You have really proven yourself, and does it often surprise you? You are a voracious researcher.
Yeah, I love research like a crazy person. I'm also a huge reader.
Yeah, but where'd you go to high school? Where'd you go to college? What'd you study? And
I didn't go to college.
Neither did I. That's what I mean.
I didn't want to. I wanted to start life.
How did you start it?
Went to Los Angeles and started acting. And I think that's part of it being everything I do, from acting and directing and writing, I think it's all the same. It's telling a story, being a storyteller, and I see them all, you know, parts of the same thing.
Had you been fascinated and passionate about any specific subject academically or scholarly before you came to...
No, but I love this era. I love the 30s. I've always read about it. I love those old movies. And then from starting the burlesque and then my film on the Siamese twins, vaudeville and circus, they're all kind of the same, you know, pop culture at the same time that was really huge. And I had no idea how huge it was in our culture. So it was interesting.
Well, you've made... it's your territory now, as far as I'm concerned. I know there are other books written about it, but in following your passion without a kind of pragmatic, I want to be a best-selling author, I mean, this is a genuine extension of your passion. What was the show you were doing in L.A. that had to do with burlesque? I know it ran for a long time somewhere.
We did different variations of it. It was called Star, I'd Rather Be a Mistress, and she was, you know, a mistress, and I had dancing boys and everything. And I had modeled her sort of on a Gypsy Rose Lee Mae West, which led to the burlesque thought.
Well, your latest book is Feuding Fan Dancers. You're going to be on all the way till 3 if you can do it.
Of course I can.
Leslie has a place in Chicago. You mostly live in Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about your husband, too, because Bob Zemeckis is a notable film director. He's got a new movie coming out called Marwin, which from the trailer I saw last week, I don't really understand, which is probably for the best. It stars Steve Carell. He has also made...
And me, I'm in it.
You are?
I am.
Do you play one of those little tiny people? It's fascinating on some level. It's terribly compelling, but I'm like, what is this movie about? Someone is beating up Steve Carell, and then he's like a little soldier. But it's a Bob Zemeckis movie, and Bob has won Academy Awards and made such films as Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Back to the Future, Forrest Gump, and not most recently, but the movie Flight, which I thought was one of Denzel Washington's greatest performances. He's a kid from Roseland.
Yep.
So you have a serious Chicago tie, and you have a place here, which is not far from one of the places you love to go research.
Oh, I love the Chicago History Museum. For every project, I think I've been in there. Everyone.
I'm keeping Leslie Zemeckis here all the way until 3 o'clock. We are going to talk... And I am even going to read from, and I don't do that unless I really like the book and really like the writing. It's not going to be long, a few paragraphs, but it's been as your official biographer or unofficial biographer, it's been an amazing thing to watch you grow as a writer. And I think this book is a leap ahead. The others are good, but this one is quite special. Welcome back to me, Rick Hogan, filling in for John Williams. Tomorrow night at 7 p.m., if you go to Volumes, a book cafe, which is a fantastic bookstore run by very nice women, you will get to meet Leslie Zemeckis and buy a copy of her latest book. You can buy all her books, but you should buy her latest book, The Cause for This Party, Feuding Fan Dancers, Faith Bacon, Sally Rand, and The Golden Age of the Showgirl. She will also have there Fan Dancers. I cannot believe you found Fan Dancers in 2018.
They're everywhere.
I haven't seen one. What do you mean they're everywhere?
Well, you got to go to the bookstore tomorrow night.
Well, I do know that there has been, not coinciding exactly with your rediscovering burlesque, I mean, there's been a recent rise of that art form without the baggy pants comics and without the other idiots. A woman in Chicago named Michelle Lamour, who I know you know well, has sort of resurrected that whole thing. We're going to talk about Mabel Stark. We'll tell you about her. She was a tiger tamer, perhaps the greatest tiger tamer of all time. But I want to read you a little something from Feuding Fan Dancers. I will not read until later the beginning of the book. The book begins in Chicago. There is a ton of Chicago in this book because these two ladies, I think, first encountered each other at the Century of Progress exhibition along the lakefront in 1933 and 34, where another fascinating guy character was involved named Mike Todd, too. Not involved with them, but he was something, too. This is Leslie Zemeckis' writing, and I said that she has grown as a writer with each book, this one, Feuding Fan Dancers, being the latest. Here is something that could suffice as an introduction for you. Both enjoyed the dance. Perhaps they had no talent for anything else. Perhaps they didn't need to. Both were showgirls who emerged from the chorus line to demand the audience look at them, to confront a woman's sexuality owned wholly by that woman. Both Faith and Sally sought sensationalism. They lived unconventional lives, for the most part, without the influence of a man or the acceptance of society. That should be on a book jacket, because that is it's deep in the book. One of many, many great paragraphs in this book. I know and knew a great deal about Sally Rand. I knew nothing about Faith Bacon, and I find her life equally interesting and seriously more tragic than that of Sally Rand. Could you tell me and the listeners a little about Faith Bacon before they buy your book?
Yes, she was a Ziegfeld Follies girl in 1930. She was one of Ziegfeld's rival was Earl Carroll. He had the Vanity Show on Broadway, these big reviews where tons and tons of naked girls and dancers and showgirls, and Faith was dubbed by him and then Ziegfeld as the world's most beautiful girl. She had she could stand nude, completely legal on Broadway, and she did with holding two big fans. And then she got an idea, well, I'll move and I'll cover myself. It still got her arrested at a matinee. The show had just opened. By that night, it was standing room only. The show was sold out after that, and she became a huge star in the papers for every little thing.
She then came here. She learned that there was another woman in Chicago doing something with fans as well.
Yeah.
And sort of came here to confront and compete with and to best and to put out of business the famous Sally Rand.
Exactly. Sally came here 33, did her fan dance, became hugely, hugely famous, brought in millions literally to see her at the fair. When the fair came back in 34, Faith's like, what's this woman I'm hearing about doing the fan dance? She came, she got a job easily because of who she was. And the first night, Sally showed up and sat in the front row to watch her. Very nice.
One of the things that differentiated these two performers was that Sally Rand was something. She wasn't only a publicity hound. She was something of a genius at publicity. She famously, in Chicago, one day I think she was arrested four times in one day.
Yes.
But she famously, a la, Guinevere, rode a white horse.
Yes, Lady Godiva.
Yeah, Lady Godiva, I mean.
Yeah, but she also did, before she did that, you're talking about at the fair, she broke her way in being nude and on a horse to a ball that William Randolph Hearst's wife was hosting, which is crazy. But a year or so before that, she was part of the artist ball who annually had a Lady Godiva, and she came in nude. She wanted to bring a horse. They wouldn't allow her, so she said, well, get a door and the busboys can, like, ride me around. She would do anything for publicity.
There was, Faith Bacon, a real, and I've talked about this, it is Leslie Zemeckis in your book, Feuding Fan Dancers. She's one of the most tragic figures I've encountered in as long as I can remember.
She was called the Marilyn Monroe of her day, and she's really why I became obsessed and wanted to write this story. And it couldn't be just a story about Faith Bacon, because her life really had a lot to do with Sally Rand.
Oh, yeah. But she had a terrible, terrible accident where her legs were...
Yes.
I don't know if it was an accident.
Yeah.
Or...
No, it was. She was dancing or posing, I'm not sure which, on a glass, kind of like a drum or something, and she just fell through it and cut up her legs terribly.
And that sort of made it tough to do what she did. Of these two women, you do a remarkable job of bringing them both to life, Faith Bacon and Sally Rand, and their sort of conflict, and also detailing what the meaning, the true meaning of what it was to be a showgirl. Define it for me now. What is a showgirl?
I mean, it's a lot of hard work.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, you know.
And it's a short career. It's a very, very short and terribly demanding career. But these two, too, were, Sally Rand especially, was, as they say, a tough old broad. She was, for those of you who have read the book, The Right Stuff, she is a featured player in Tom Wolfe's remarkable book about space travel. She did in her... Boy, she must have been in her 60s by then, right?
Mm-hmm. She was born in 1904.
Yeah, she was. She, in, after in the Houston Astrodome when they were celebrating the first astronauts, she did her famous fan dance recreated in the movie The Right Stuff after Sally Rand had died by some other fan dancer, I suppose. But how you detailed in the epilogue, Sally Rand just kept at it, didn't she?
Absolutely. But she had the advantage, partly because of the Chicago World's Fair. She was really associated with that. She was really associated with the hope that people needed at the time about
middle
the Great Depression.
Depression, sure.
They really thought, you know, if this little girl who's got nothing, and she had nothing, she was, you know, broke and desperate at that point. If this girl's got something beside, you know, her fans, and she can make it, we can. And because she was associated with that, as she aged, she kept getting hired for that nostalgia value.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, she was respected in that way.
Well, you would think, and there were, and you make, there are parallels between both of these women and Marilyn Monroe. And you think to yourself now, had Marilyn Monroe not died, that there would be that kind of thing going on with her too now. I mean, she wouldn't be naked right. somewhere, but there would be, in the same way there is with Elvis,
right?
Let's say, on the other side. Leslie Zemeckis will be appearing and signing her book.
With a fan dancer.
Yes, there'll be a fan dancer. Who is the fan dancer? Not that we would know her name, but...
Eva LaFiva.
Oh, that's a good name. Where does she normally fan dance?
She's here. She's local. I've been getting people from local.
But not when she's not doing book events at people's
You'll have
homes.
To ask her. Yeah, no. There's shows around.
Yeah, there are shows all over the place. Yeah. Michelle L'Amour still puts on a lot of shows. Welcome back to me finishing up my fill-in on the John Williams Show. If you Google Zemeckis and movies, you're likely to get a lot of stuff about Leslie Zemeckis's husband Bob, who has made a lot of movies, and about whom you said, told me, that you don't consider yourself a filmmaker. Bob's a filmmaker. Indeed, he is, but so are you. If you Google Zemeckis and then Mabel, Tiger Trainer, you will get a fantastic movie about a woman named Mabel Stark, who is one of the great feminist heroes of the 20th century. She sort of invented herself.
Completely.
Completely invented herself and did become as famous, you should see, as Leslie has, and I looked them up before writing about it, you should see the old clippings from the Chicago Tribune about this woman. You would think that she was running for governor now. Astonishing.
Yeah. You know, that's, you know, it's funny. Almost everybody actually that I have written about or done a film about in their day was hugely famous. And you can talk to people today and no clue.
I know. Well, that's one of the things that always intrigues me about history, that how history is able to bury so many people in dust. And you just do not realize how incredibly, I just reread for about the fourth time the biography of Mike Todd, mm-hmm. written by a guy named Art Cohn, who died in a plane crash with Todd when they were leaving. Elizabeth Taylor would have been on that plane. She was Mike Todd's wife. And they both died in that plane crash. And Mike Todd, who spent a great deal of time in Chicago, one of the great hustlers and innovators I've ever known. And oh, yeah, there used to be like a Mike Todd theater, right? Well, it was a lot more than that. In order to induce you and seduce you into buying Leslie Zemeckis' latest book, Feuding Fan Dancers, and Leslie does have a very, very good website, LeslieZemeckis.com, I'm going to read you the way in which the prologue ends and tell me you don't want to buy this book. Ready? Like numerous third-rate hotels, there would have been a long, narrow hallway with a grimy window at the end. Imagine hazy light from the dim hallway casting uneven shadows over the pattern of the worn carpet. Neither light nor optimism could penetrate the broken souls in a cheap hotel. A last stop, a temporary asylum from dashed dreams and delusional schemes. Impulsively, or had she been thinking of it all day, the blonde raced toward the window. Her roommate yelled after her. A low-heeled foot clung to the rim of the ledge. There was no time to turn back. Her roommate grabbed at her skirt, feeling the assurance of fabric in her rough hand. Then, horrifyingly, she felt it give too fast, and the material slid through her hand. No! She screamed as her troubled friend vanished from sight. It was not an easy end to a life that had not been lived easily. Ironically, 1956 was a leap year. Leslie Zemeckis, that is very, very good writing.
Thank you.
Do you know that, or do you,
I do. I do.
You,
I'm proud of
you. Finally,
I'm proud
do
of
yeah.
This yeah,
yeah. And you have come to the kind of academic literary world after in I think what is a really wonderful way is a previous life as a performer, and I think you get it in a way that most writers don't. You have a sense of narrative. You have a sense of the drive. Some of it, I think, coming from some of the subjects about whom you've written, too. Don't you feel that way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can see their stories when I'm writing them.
This would make a remarkable movie. And you're right. Faith Bacon was a beautiful, beautiful woman. Sally Rand, attractive, but
Faith
not...
Is-
With, no comparison.
No, and I found it's interesting. I was Googling around for stuff. I saw footage of this woman, and it said, stripper Sally Rand. And I looked at it, and I watched it, and it's Faith. And it's so rare. It's astonishing. 1931, and you can see how beautiful she is, and her dancing, how gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
It is a sad end for both of these women, but a great deal of the book does indeed take place in Chicago. You're out doing promoting the book wisely. You will be tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Volumes Book Cafe, which is a great independent bookstore at 1474 North Milwaukee Avenue, 7 o'clock, and there will be a fan dancer there performing a la Sally Rand or doing her own distinctive kind of thing. Because Sally Rand's fan dance was a book I wrote with my father many years ago called Yesterday Chicago, for which we went out and talked to a bunch of old press photographers, has a remarkable photo of Sally Rand kind of totally naked, hidden behind an opaque kind of screen. And I remember interviewing the photographer was very old even at the time in the 70s, and his take on what it was like to go upstairs and visit Sally Rand in this room is just priceless. So Sally Rand has been part of my life for a long time, but you bring her back to life vividly, Leslie Zemeckis. And Faith Bacon, you have done her, it's not your place in the world to do her proud or to do her justice, but you have done that. Does that make you, do you sense that too?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, what I want to do with these people. I don't base my research or anything that I find to make them look better, or I just want to tell the truth, but I do think their stories have value.
I do too. I do too. You told me once that I said you're intrigued by an interesting realm, and you said, I guess I am just drawn to outsiders and underdogs. And
definitely,
one of the great things about it is you elevate them. It's great to meet you face to face. Look in the Tribune in the upcoming weeks for a review of the feuding fan dancers, because I really do want to write about my old buddy Sally Rand and this one of my new tragic heroes, Faith Bacon. It's great to meet you. Knock 'em dead at Volumes tomorrow.
Thank you.
7 p.m., 1474 North Milwaukee Avenue. Leslie has a wonderful website, and that's how you can get her other books and her movies and everything else about you.